This is the Live Your Edge podcast, episode 22. This is Gilbert. Welcome to the podcast. Today, our guest is Corey Kupfert. Corey is an expert strategist, dealmaker, and business consultant with more than 30 years of professional negotiating experience as a successful entrepreneur and attorney. He is the founder and president of Authentic Enterprises, as well as Authentic Business Academy. Corey is a passionate advocate and leader in the entrepreneurial space, and has been a member of the New York chapter of the Entrepreneurs Association since 2008, serving as a board member from 2010 to 2015, including two terms as its chapter president. He's a professional member of the National Speakers Association and an in-demand speaker at conferences nationwide. He has appeared in numerous media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Investment News, FinancialPlanning.com, New York Daily News, and DailyWorth.com. Some of his high-profile clients include best-selling business author David Bach and A.J. Gupta, financial advisor to Tony Robbins. Today, we will talk about how to negotiate for anything that you want in your life, and how to achieve clarity with what you truly want, and how to say no to things that you don't want. Join me in welcoming Corey Kupfert. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm here with Corey Kupfert, and we are going to talk about negotiating for pretty much anything in your life. Corey is a very experienced negotiator, and he's been doing this for over 30 years. Corey, why don't you share a little bit about your story, how you got into negotiating, and how that had an effect on your career as a result?
Sure, Gilbert. It's great to be with you and your audience. I mean, I've been professionally negotiating ever since I started out as an attorney, and I, became a deal lawyer. So we do, my entire career, I've done a lot of kind of contracts and deals and that kind of stuff. And obviously negotiation is a big part of that. But frankly, if you ask my mother, she would tell you I've been negotiating since I could talk. So I think part of it was a little bit innate, as a person, I always sort of loved it. And my negotiating approach has evolved. When I was a kid, I was always negotiating only with the view of, getting what I wanted. Didn't matter how it affected anybody else, right? As a kid, you just try to, you want what you want. But as you go along in business and you realize that while negotiating is such a huge skill, that it is normally just part of what's going to be an ongoing relationship and some sort of deal, business partnership, employment situation, joint venture, whatever it is. So, I evolved a whole approach over these 30 plus years of negotiating that I call authentic negotiating. And that's really not only what I use, but also what I speak on and teach in my workshops.
So for you, what does it mean to be an authentic negotiator?
Yeah. So the first thing is, people, automatically when they think about authentic, they think about things like integrity and that kind of stuff. And that's all in there. But for me, what authenticity means even more so in the context of what I'm talking about is being true to yourself, is really understanding exactly what you want and what you don't want, and having your negotiating approach and style aligned with that. One of the things that I've learned over decades of doing deals and helping entrepreneurial companies grow, and my client base is mainly entrepreneurs, and I deal with owners of companies and some of the bigger clients, the C-level executives. What you find sometimes is that, there's these external forces that say, oh, you got to grow, or, you got to get funded, and then you got to grow fast, or you need to, do deals or whatever it is. And the question you always want to ask is why? If we're not, especially our entrepreneurial clients, you become an entrepreneur because in my mind, you want to create not only a business, but a life that you want. You want to have the freedom and flexibility to do what you want when you want, right? And build your company and your life along with that. So when you're negotiating your deals and your partnerships, it should be aligned with that. So for me, what it came down to on authentic negotiating is there's a core framework that is three items. It's clarity, detachment, and equilibrium. And it's an internal body of work that I encourage people to do, in addition to the external research, to get first total clarity on exactly what's acceptable and what's not acceptable to you and why. And I am amazed at, I mean, I represent people in, you know, all different size negotiations, but people go into multi-million dollar deals without the level of clarity on exactly what they want, what will work for them, what won't work for them, and why. And then they run into trouble on the deals because they haven't done that initial piece, which is the C and CD clarity.
So you also wrote a book on authentic negotiating, which you highlight these three things: clarity, detachment, and equilibrium. So let's talk a little bit about clarity. And you mentioned in the book a lot about finding your truth and being clear about it and not lying to yourself. So maybe you can help elaborate, or we can go do a deep dive on this.
Sure. Yeah. So here's the thing. Some of the toughest work, and frankly, I know, you know, our audience here is, you know, a lot of, you know, mostly millennials and younger folks. And I am not in that category. I'm a little older, but I remember when I, you know, in my younger years, you know, there's a lot that drives us, whether it's pressure from family or pressure from expectations of friends, or, you know, how we are perceived or how we look, or bosses or things like that. The challenge is that, and as a society, we're much more likely to be pushed to look to outside forces, right? And also developing skills. But what we're less often encouraged to do is to do the deep inner work within ourselves to really understand who we are and what makes us tick and what we truly want at a core level. What's totally aligned with our values, with our vision, with our desires, and that is informed by some external voices and outside factors and people we trust and, you know, other people's views, but is not dictated by them, where it really is coming from an authentic place internally. So when I talk about clarity when it comes to negotiating, this, you know, can apply beyond it. Sure, there's that external research where if you're negotiating to acquire a company, or you're negotiating a partnership, or you're negotiating, you know, even, you know, salary on a job, you're going to do your external research to find out what the market is and what other people have done and all that kind of stuff. And those are inputs, and you should do that. But the key work that people skimp on is that internal deep dive into, hey, why am I looking to do this particular deal? Why am I in this negotiation? What am I truly trying to achieve? And what is, and am I looking at what I want truly from the place of something that will align with my inner truth? Or is it being just influenced by outside factors, what other people think I should do? Without doing that internal work, what happens sometimes is you actually achieve the deal or finish the negotiation, and you end up in a place where you realize later that, well, great, you know, I got what I thought I wanted, but I didn't really want that. So that's the deep level of clarity. The next piece on clarity is actually on the particular deal, understanding all of the material provisions of whatever type of negotiation it is, and being 100% clear on exactly what's acceptable and what's not acceptable on each of those terms. And one of the blessings and curses we have is, you know, those of us who are entrepreneurs, or even, you know, successful people who are up and coming in their careers, is that one of the, you know, like I consider myself, I'm good on my feet, right? I can handle things on the fly. And that's a characteristic that a lot of us entrepreneurs value. And at the same time, it can make us not do the prep work that we want to do. We think we can wing it and handle it. And when you're in an important negotiation, if you haven't gotten crystal clear on every material term and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, then you don't know how to structure the strategy and design of the negotiation. You don't know really when to say yes or not. You don't know when, in the heat of the negotiation, how not to get thrown off. So that clarity piece is the first, like that's the bedrock before you even get to the other one.
So you mentioned also about having a bottom line you referenced, which is knowing when to walk away. How do you go about establishing a bottom line?
Yeah, so there's this concept that I call true bottom line. There's a couple of distinctions on it. So when I say, and it relates totally to clarity, when I say clarity and I say true bottom line, what I mean is, like, let's say it's a monetary factor, because this should apply to any term of the deal, but it's easy to illustrate with something that's monetary. What I say is true clarity and true bottom line is when you know it's not a penny less or a penny more. Okay. So I'll say to somebody, let's say I have a client who's looking to sell their company. Let's say they've been fortunate, they've started up a company, things go well, and then now they have an opportunity to sell it. And I say to them, what do you want to get for your company? They say, well, I'd love to get $12 million for the company. Okay, great. What would you be happy with? What would you, you know, what would be acceptable? Well, you know, I'd be fine with 11. All right, what's your bottom line? My bottom line is $10 million. All right, you won't sell it for anything less than $10 million? No, nothing less. Then I always test that. And how do I test it? I say to them, listen, let's say we've got another 10 or 15 or 20, whatever the number is, important terms of the deal, right? How you get paid, maybe that you, you know, only have an employment or consulting agreement for a certain length of time, or your key employees are hired, or whatever your other terms are. And let's say on every single one of those other important terms of the deal, you get what you want. But instead of the $10 million minimum that you said you wanted, it's $9,999,999.99. Literally a penny less than you say your minimums. Do you take the deal? And inevitably, most of my clients, or when I do workshops and seminars on this, people say, yeah, of course I take the deal, Corey. It's only a penny. I mean, what, you know? But that's the wrong answer. When I say wrong answer, not in the way of judgment, the point is this. When you go into a negotiation and you're not firm on a bottom line number or other term, then what if it were a penny less than that, right? So now instead of 999,999 cents, it's 98 cents. What about 97 cents, 96 cents? And it's a ridiculous way to put it, but the point of it is that you can go down a penny at a time, down to zero. So there's, you can end up at zero. So there's literally got to be a number, a penny less than, or a penny more than, or if it's the term of your consulting agreement, a day less than, or a day more than, or the time period in which you have to deliver the services or the goods. You know, if you're contracting with somebody to whatever, do their website, you know, when do you have to deliver? You know, you want to get down to that level of clarity so that you don't get this slip in negotiation where you end up giving more and more and more and then end up with a deal that you don't want. So I do that test with clients on not a penny less or a penny more to illustrate how clear they need to be on each of the terms.
Would you say that that's also sort of being rigid?
Yeah, it's a great question. People, that question comes up a lot because in my book, Authentic Negotiating, one of the things I talk about, I have a chapter on the top six reasons negotiations fail. And rigidity is one of the reasons negotiations fail. So people say to me all the time, well, Corey, you just said I need to get clarity down to not a penny less, but you also tell me not to be rigid. How do you reconcile those things? And this is the way I reconcile it. You never want to be rigid. You want to be open to alternatives. You want to be open to different structures. You don't want to be rigid around the timing. All that gets you in trouble. But the difference is that rigidity often comes with an emotion. Like, you know, I'm almost like, even when I'm saying rigid to you, I'm clenching my fist here, right? There's like there's something that happens in your body. There's a feeling of like resistance, of you being not open, of being rigid. Whereas clarity comes from a place of like total, like nobody's a bad person. You're not in reaction to anything. You're just clear that it won't work for you below that. You're still open to them coming up with a creative solution, right? So they may say, hey, I can't give you the 10 million now. I'll give you 9 million. It's below your minimum. But then we're going to have some sort of earnout provision or other provision that allows you maybe to make even more than the million later on. Oh, okay. If I'm open and I'm not rigid, that may work for me because I might not have thought of that, but it may ultimately get me at least my 10 million and I'm fine. You know, so the difference between rigidity and clarity is the energy around it. With clarity, you're just clear and that nobody's bad. You know, when you walk away from a deal from a place of clarity, if you and I are negotiating a deal and you and I say I need X and we're open, we try to come up with creative solutions and it doesn't work for you, you can only pay me to 80% of X, then if I'm in a place of clarity, I'm not upset with you. You're not a bad guy. It's just that your objectives and my objectives didn't align right now. Maybe we'll do a deal later. Maybe we won't. Maybe I'm not meant to do a deal with you. Whereas if I was in a place of rigidity, I would be upset about it. There'd be judgment around it. There's the energy around it. So that's the difference.
So this is is it also what you refer to as detachment when it comes to being detached from the deal?
Yeah. So that's in the CDE formulation, after clarity is detachment. And that's exactly right. What detachment says is that if we're negotiating a deal, I should have a preference we get the deal done because why am I wasting my time negotiating with you, you know, over the deal, the contract or the business partnership or wherever it is, you know, so I'm not saying you don't have a preference, but ultimately, if you've gotten crystal clear on your objectives and what will work for you, and you're open to creative alternatives, but even with that, it doesn't work, then you need to be just as fine with walking away from the deal than with doing the deal. And again, not from a place of anger or upset, just from a place of, hey, okay, well, listen, I really appreciate it, but you know, your objectives and my objectives don't align right now, so it's not time for us to do a deal. And the problem, what happens is people get attached, right? Classic example was where they have a potential buyer for their, you know, for the company, right? They think there's a chunk of money coming and get all excited about it, and they're already either spending it or looking at how they can invest it in the next venture, or where they're gonna travel around the world or whatever. And they get psychologically and emotionally invested in the deal being done, and it's far from done until it's done. And then what happens is, you know, let's say, you know, I mean, I've seen it over and over again, deal terms change. Oh, you know, we did some due diligence and now we got to reduce our offer by, you know, another 10% or 20%. And they end up taking a deal or spending a lot of money going down the line and then finally decided not to do a deal, but they paid, you know, whereas like me and accountants and investment bankers, a lot of money because they got too attached to the deal. So the best negotiators I work with, you know, my clients, other negotiators that I'm up against, whatever, are ultimately detached. You know, they have a preference, but they're clear on what their terms are. And if they're able to achieve those, great. And if not, not. And, you know, ultimately what it comes down to, and this gets easier with time and experience, what it comes down to is that they, you know, basically trust if it's right, it should happen. And if it's not, it doesn't. And if you force it, it's going to be worse. And they don't get their ego involved. And it doesn't mean they're a failure if the deal doesn't happen. You know, none of that comes about. They're just clear-headed on their objectives. And if they can achieve them, then they do the deal. If they can't, they don't. And they're equally fine either way.
So would you also say that if they're detached, they're coming from a place of abundance, as in there's chances for deals to be done down the road, but I'm not going to be, this is not the only option. And if it doesn't work out, it's fine. And I'm not going to be swayed because of some term in the deal, and I'm just going to remain calm and walk away if necessary.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, if you are in a place of scarcity, which is, you know, what I look at as the opposite of abundance, right? Then it's really hard to stay detached. You know, if you're a software developer, you get a chance to potentially do a deal with Google or Microsoft or Apple or, you know, whoever, right? Let's pick a, you know, and this is the deal of a lifetime, right? And you're attached to, it's easy to be attached to that outcome, right? It's, you know, let's say this is something that's way beyond any opportunity you've ever had. But if you find out that they're only going to pay you a small amount of money and then own all your intellectual property, right? You know, or, you know, the deal otherwise doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense. Then if you're attached to the outcome because you think it would be cool to do a deal with Google, and by the way, you may make a decision that there's other reasons why you're going to sell your first deal, you know, to a major player cheap because it gives you credibility, connections, whatever. I'm not saying, you know, that's if you make a clear-headed decision. But the point is, if you get attached because of that cachet, or you get attached because you're, you know, and ultimately you're right, it does come down to this abundance versus scarcity mentality. Because if you think that chance with Google, in my made-up example, is the only chance you're ever going to have to do a deal like that, and, you know, you're lucky to have it, and that or something better or something even close to as good is never going to show up again, well, you know, then the odds are you're attached and you're probably going to make a bad deal. But if you're the kind of person who can believe in abundance, and by the way, I fundamentally, it's a fundamental principle in my life that I believe the universe is abundant, and I believe that there's things are accessible and you can trust in that, then it's a lot easier to stay detached because, you know what, this may seem like a great deal, but the terms don't really work for you. There will be another one.
So is that how we can learn to say no to things? Because I feel like, especially millennials, we're often presented with a lot of options, and sometimes we get sidetracked or distracted because of all of these options. How can we learn to say no? So you mentioned before it was about clarity, finding out what is it your truth is, and saying just not taking anything below your true bottom line. So how can we go about really evaluating what to say no to if the terms are not as clear cut?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great conversation because, listen, there are people, I'm going to sort of start out at a more macro level and even just negotiating on that question because it's like a life question, right? There are, and this is something that I had to learn over the years. You know, there are people who come from circumstances where they actually don't have a lot of options, right? You know, they're just looking for opportunities. And that's the thing we hear of that's challenging. You know, people have these, you know, challenges, and sometimes they have these great stories about overcoming this challenge. What's talked about a lot less is people who are fortunate enough to be in a situation where they have a number of options. All of them, maybe many of them are good, right, in various ways. But sometimes the good stands in the way of the great. Mm. Or sometimes what we do, and trust me, I've done this at various points in my life, is that I know that I have a calling to do something bigger. And then these other opportunities that come up are good opportunities. And I go do them, and nobody could fault me for that because, well, they're good opportunities. They're opportunities, by the way, that a lot of other people don't get to have. But what I'm really doing by going over and doing those things is avoiding what I'm really here to do, is avoiding playing even bigger than that. And some, you know, in some ways that could be a cop-out. It's sort of the way that, you know, actually high-achieving, successful people compared to most people often actually don't perform and achieve at their highest levels or really to their fullest potential by actually not saying no to the good to make room for the great.
So would you say that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's another internal journey, right? To really figure out what that is, because it's impossible to do unless you really, you know, have that clarity on what you're really here to do, what you're called to do. I have this concept that I talk of. I mean, people have various formulations of it, but my formulation is this concept called highest and best use. And what I say is, in fact, I give some of the entrepreneurs that I mentor and have worked with, either as a lawyer or just, I was very active for a decade in entrepreneurs organization. I was the president of the chapter, so I would mentor a lot of companies. I give them this exercise, and I've done it myself over the years, I call it my highest and best use exercise. And so the way I define a highest and best use area is that it's got to have three factors. One, it's got to be something that you're great at, right? You're just really good at it. It's your particular skill, talent, etc. But that's not enough, because there's a lot of stuff that I'm really good at that I don't like doing, you know? Like, you know, as a lawyer, I can draft a great asset purchase agreement, but I have people who do that for me now because that's not my asset best use, so not, it doesn't excite me. So the second piece of it is you have to be passionate about it, right? So you got to be great at it, you got to be passionate about it. It's got to be something that lights you up that, you know, you love to do. And most people stop there. Most people figure out, hey, I want to do something great at it, I'm passionate about it. But they forget, if you're building a company, if you're an entrepreneur or you're in an executive position working for a company where you want to benefit them, whatever position you're in, there's a third factor, and that's what I call, it's got to be highly leveraged, meaning it's got to be something that moves the needle and makes a big difference. And this sort of relates back to the conversation of what we had with the distractions and not saying no to the good over the great, right? Because there's a lot of stuff that you might be great at and passionate about, but it's not the stuff that moves the needle the most. And if you go do that and you're not on the stuff that's highly leveraged to make it a big, big difference for your company or organization, then you're avoiding your full potential. So if you can define your highest and best use areas, great at it, passionate about it, makes a big difference, moves the needle, highly leveraged, right? If you have those three things, and then you work to focus only your time on those things. And listen, if you are an entrepreneur and own your own business, it's easy to try to, I mean, it's still hard because you've got a million distractions, but at least you have control over that. If you work with somebody else, you may be in a position where somebody's prescribing job duties to you that may or may not be consistent with that. But even in that case, you can try to focus more and try to work your way in the company. And if you have good management leadership, talk to them about, you know, where you think you can best serve the company in a role that's more designed for your highest and best use areas. And so what I have people do, and this is an exercise that is sobering, and a lot of people will avoid doing it, but the people who do it, it's made a major difference. Once you identify your highest and best use areas, I have people track for a week or two, whatever they get a representative sample. It's got to be at least a week, sometimes two, of literally keep a time diary of everything they do that day, you know, during their working hours. Okay, without judgment, you just write it down, right? Whatever it is, you know, spend a half hour doing emailing. I, you know, drafted this agreement. I coded this program. I designed this website, whatever it is. And then after the week or two is up, only then, you go back and you look through the list and you figure out what percentage of your time you actually spent in your highest and best use areas and what percentage you were doing other stuff. When I first did this exercise, probably 16, 17 years ago, I determined, at least I told myself, that I was only spending 20% of my time in my highest and best use areas. And I was devastated. I was so disappointed. The funny part is, in hindsight, when I look back, I think I lied to myself, and it was probably only 5 to 7% of my time. But like, I couldn't even deal with the, I gave myself the benefit of the doubt on a lot of judgment calls just to get that 20%, because even that seems so low. And that's, by the way, natural if you don't focus on this, because especially, as an entrepreneur, I mean, when I first started out, after coming out of, from a big company, I was going to, this is pre-internet. I'm older than, like I said, than some of your audience. I was running to Staples to buy my own supplies, right? I was, typing my own stuff. When I first started out, I couldn't afford a team, and obviously I added another time. So, it's natural actually not to be in your highest and best use at the earliest stages of your career or your company, but you want to work towards that. So when you do the exercise and you look at the gap between what your highest and best use areas are and what percentage of time you spend in them versus everything else, it's not intended to depress you, but I always believe that once you identify the gap, then you get to, first of all, it becomes distinguished, you become aware of it. And then you get to focus on it and just make improvements. So then what you do is you say, okay, all of these things that I'm doing that are not my highest and best use areas. The first question is, what of that stuff just doesn't need to be done? Not only by me, but by nobody. What is just the time wasted, the distractions, the stuff that really just nobody should do? And you get rid of that. The next thing you look at is, what system or process can I put in place that would have me not have to do this? Right? The best companies start systemizing things, so that repeatable processes are built in. Then the next question is, okay, who in my company can I delegate this to? If it's not my highest and best use area, somebody else should be doing it. And if you have staff, you want to delegate down as much as you can. If you don't have staff, then the question is, who do I need to either hire or contract with? And nowadays there's so many more options than when I started. I mean, now you got virtual assistants, you got Upwork, you got Fiverr, there's a million places you can find people to help you without making a full-time or even a part-time employment commitment, right? So who do I need to either hire or contract with or outsource to be able to do this stuff? And listen, it's a process. You may know you ideally want to do that, but not have the money right now to do that, but you're going to work on it over time. And you're also going to understand that sometimes you got to make a jump and hire people to do that low, that stuff that is below your highest and best use areas, because you can do it at $12 or $15 an hour. And if you go out and if you're freed up from that stuff and you can go out and just get one more client, you can cover that cost for months or a year. You're gonna identify that and then just work to shift it. When I first did this, I jumped from my 20%, quote unquote, my early five, to maybe 50% in a year. It took me about 8 years to go from 50% up to 85 or 90%. Because it just takes time, right? You got to build the right team. You got to get systems in place. You got to figure out who you can outsource to. But that's the biggest thing one of the biggest things that has made me successful in business, because nowadays I spend 85 or 90% of my time. I've actually recently dropped back down because we've grown from 90, back down to 85 or maybe pushing 80. And now I'm like, okay, wait a second, I'm doing too much stuff right now that's not in my highest and best use areas. What does that mean? And for me, it means I need to hire someone else. So it gives me a whole framework on how I build my business and how I'm focused on what I can make the biggest difference in, what I love. And it actually accelerates your business growth and the impact you can have on your clients or customers or whatever you want to impact.
So what are some of the ways we can delegate some of this work? You mentioned virtual assistants, Upwork, and Fiverr. So once we identify what these things are, we write it down on a piece of paper, we just figure out, okay, this is taking up 6 hours of my week and I don't need to be the one doing this. So let me go and find someone that can do it and outsource it. Is that what I hear?
Absolutely. And listen, like I said, there's so many, technology and other solutions nowadays. But also, listen, one thing that hasn't changed is the first thing I always do before I jump on a site like Upwork, which I've used, or Fiverr, any of those outsourcing, there's a million virtual assistant companies and sites, either offshore or onshore or whatever. But the first thing I do is I just reach out to people I know, whether it's posting it on social media or making specific phone calls or emails or texts, to people I know. you know, it, obviously you can get a recommendation. Like I used to have somebody internally who was handling my bookkeeping, but she does like five other things for me. And as we grow, it's busy. So now I decided, hey, we're gonna outsource the bookkeeping. You know, I could have gone on a site, whatever. But the first thing I did was reach out to a bunch of people, including my accountant, who I wanted to ask for a recommendation, not realizing that he had actually increased his in-house bookkeeping capacity for clients, and he had somebody who could do it for me, which is great. You know, now I got a trusted relationship with my accountant who's now going to be doing my bookkeeping. So definitely reach out to people you know, but there's so many, these sites and other options where you can get people to help, in a way that where you don't have, not only a full-time or part-time commitment, but where you can, if they're not working out, you can say next, let's try someone else.
Love where this is going. So we started off, getting clear about what is it we want to do. And then we figure out what to say no to and establishing our bottom line. So where does equilibrium come into play in, for instance, an entrepreneur trying to get what he wants in life?
Yeah. So that's the third piece of the CDE framework that I have in authentic negotiating. And you're right to ask the question on, that it applies beyond negotiating. All of those factors do. So I'll start out in the micro and then go to the macro. So the way I talk about it in negotiating is that you've gotten that total clarity, exactly what works for you, what doesn't. You go into negotiations attached to the outcome. You're in a place of abundance. You realize that, it'll work or it won't work. You have a preference, but you're okay either way. Now, the equilibrium part is, how do you maintain that clarity and detachment and not get thrown off? So for example, in a negotiation, people, maybe they do the work and come in a great place, but then the negotiation gets tough. Somebody tells you your company's only worth half of what you think it is. Somebody uses some, crazy negotiating tactic against you. The negotiations get tense. It's easy to get thrown off. And it's the same thing in the broader conversation in life, right? Some of us do these, I've done all kinds of business, seminars and personal growth courses and whatever. And, you come out of one of those weekends or one of those courses and you're all pumped up and you clear and whatever, and then life happens, right? Then you come back to work and your boss gives you 12 things to do that you hate, or, you come back and you have a fight with your significant other or whatever, somebody in your family gets sick. There's a million things that can distract us, and throw us off, whatever. You watch something on the news and you get pissed off about the political situation one way or the other, right? There's so much that could get thrown off. So like in negotiation in life, one of the keys is to try to maintain your equilibrium, because the problem is when you get thrown off, when you get triggered, when you get emotional, you lose your clarity and you lose your detachment. You can't be at your best. And I want to make something clear. We're humans. We have emotions. I'm not advocating being a cold robot, right? We need to feel what we feel. The difference is whether we use the emotions that come up for us as a signal to give us information about ourselves, or whether we have them control us, right? Like I'm sure your audience know of people where their emotions just control them, right? They're just always at the effect of how they feel, as opposed to saying, okay, listen, this negotiation ran into trouble, or I'm having this challenge in my job or my life, and I'm feeling sad about that, I'm feeling angry about that, I'm feeling whatever. I'm not saying you feel those things. Why am I feeling that way? How can I get myself recentered? And what is it telling me, right? If I'm pissed off about my boss, is it telling me that I'm in the wrong job? Or is it telling me that I'm actually pissed off at myself because I'm not performing? Because the boss tried to hold me accountable? And obviously he or she's probably right. I'm not performing up to my potential. And it seems like I'm pissed off at the boss, but I'm really pissed off at myself. We use the emotion to give us information and try to figure out what's truly is going on for us. And then we use whatever we can to get our place back into the equilibrium. And for a lot of people, everybody does that differently. The first thing I say to people when they say, well, how do I maintain my equilibrium in a negotiation? I ask them, well, what do you do in life? When you're off, when you're frustrated, when you have something come up, are you the kind of person that meditates? Do you go out for a run? Do you call a friend and talk it out? Do you get to go to a quiet place and read a book? What do you do that recenters you? So that's the starting point. And then actually, as to negotiating in the book, I have this thing called CPR, context, purpose, and results. It's like a particular methodology that you can use to particularly keep you on track and maintain your equilibrium in a negotiation. But in life more generally, we all need practices. We're all human. We're all going to get thrown off sometimes. The question is not whether we get thrown off. The question is whether we keep going down that road and live at the expense of our of outside forces and at the expense of our reaction or emotion to them, or whether we have ways that we get to recenter ourselves, get back to our clarity, and be able to make decisions and take action from a much more clear place and not a reactive place.
I love how you're taking the book on negotiating is taking a much more macro view of negotiating rather than going into like the very techniques and sort of the tactics and that, because the tactics are great and all, but without the understanding of when your goals and you know where you're going with the deal, it's kind of hard to apply those tactics and if it conflicts with your internal needs.
Absolutely. And listen, it's to tack a lot of the, you're right, a lot of the negotiating training, the books are all on a tactical level, and frankly, listen, some of the advice out there is actually manipulative and bad and game playing and you know not good, in fact too much of it is. But there are some really good books and courses that are approach negotiation on a tactical level, and they don't use, you know, these horrible. I mean, I read an article I think it was a little over a year ago, in one of the online major business publications, article that, gave five tricks to negotiating success. And the first one was called the flinch. And this person, basically was advocating that the first offer you get about anything, even if it was really acceptable, you flinch, like, oh my God, that's ridiculous. Like it was so inauthentic. It's like, it was one of those horrible inauthentic tactics. So you have that stuff out there, and you should avoid that stuff as a plague. But there are good tactical level negotiating trainings out there. The issue with those is really what you're alluding to, is that, if, let's say you learn some of the good tactical approaches, but you're entering in the negotiation from a place of desperation or scarcity or fear, right? Or you feel like you don't deserve it. I don't care what kind of tactics you apply on top of that stuff. You may get marginally better results, but you're not gonna be successful in negotiation just on a tactical level. But if you do that deep internal work and get to that place of clarity, detachment, and equilibrium, and if you avoid, letting the fear and the feelings of inadequacy or scarcity, or you do that inner work to really get, avoid all that stuff. And then, first of all, just with that, you're going to do way better in terms of your negotiating results than anybody who's learned any tactic but hasn't done the internal work. But then if you take some of the good tactics and strategies and techniques and add those on top of the internal work, well, now, you get to the place where you have an opportunity to be a master negotiator.
Got it. Just a few more questions and we'll wrap up the episode for today. So what is one tip you would give someone looking for a challenge to grow their life, personal growth wise?
Probably not something that people are going to hear for the first time, but I really believe in it. And that is, regularly do something that frightens the heck out of you. I believe that when we think of something, whether it's asking for a promotion at your job, whether it's taking on a new business line, whether it's launching a business, or whether it's just even, I'll give a personal example that's more of sort of a phobia or a physical thing, that if you have a fear of something, our natural tendency as human beings is to avoid that thing, right? And I believe if you build the muscle of being able to just walk into that fear, walk right up to it and take it on, that it builds basically a muscle that helps you in every place of your life. So I'll give an example where, I've done some stuff that seemingly has nothing to do with business success and life success in a vacuum, but really has been big for me. The one main phobia I have in my life is I'm afraid of heights. And I'm not like, it's funny because I joke that I'm afraid of falling, not of heights. Because some people like if I'm in a building or in a cable car and the window's closed, and I can look outside and I'm fine. But if we're hiking and we're at the top of a cliff and people are like looking over the edge, I'm the guy that's three steps back, trying to see, right? It's a real phobia. It's not just, I'm a little afraid. Like I'm almost paralyzed afraid in situations where I think I could fall off something. And despite that, every couple of years, I mean, I bungee jumped off, like a 300-foot platform. I skydived out of a plane. I've rappelled off 200-foot cliffs which for me was one of the scariest things, because when they first tell you to lean back off of a mountain, you know, just lean backwards. I'm like, no, no, that doesn't even calculate, you know. One, I do that because I don't like having anything holding me back, you know, in life. I just don't like the fact that there's something. So, and people say to me, oh, so you've broken through the fear. I'm like, no, no, I haven't broken through. The phobia is still there. I just do it anyway. And the next time I do something like that, I'm still scared like crazy. It's not like, you know, oh, I jumped out of a plane once and now I don't have a phobia. But the reason I do it, in addition to just not liking having something limiting me, and how it actually does relate to my personal and business success, is that I call upon that. Like, you know, if I'm going into a tough negotiation or I've got a tough situation in my business, right? Or, you know, a challenge with a client, the fact that, you know, and I'm worried about it, or I'm thinking, you know, or there's just even the tendency to maybe be a little afraid, oh, I'm going to lose this client, or, you know, whatever, the economy is in trouble, my business is, you know, things are tough. You know, I think about not only intellectually, but even just that feeling of breaking through that phobia and leaning back off that cliff, or jumping off that, you know, out of that plane, or being on that zip line, whatever it is. And I'm like, you know what? It is like building a muscle. And I'm like, hey, you know what? If I can, in the face of that level of phobia, I can do it anyway. I'll figure this business thing out. I'll figure this life challenge out. You know, I would just recontextualize when you're afraid of something to be from something that I should avoid or I'm not going to do, to that being a signal that it's time to take that thing on.
So it's feel the fear and do it anyway.
Exactly.
Great. And final question, what makes you happy?
Oh my God. This, you know, there's so many things. I mean, I could talk about, you know, my relationship with my wife, which is very special. I could talk about having great friends, which is huge for me. I think though, the biggest thing that is true, and it's also very consistent with what we're talking about, I am happiest when I'm living consistent with my purpose in life. Mm. Right. And for me, a lot of my life is about being of service, and I know what my business purpose is. I know what my personal life purpose is. And when I'm living in alignment with that and my actions are in alignment with that, I'm happiest. When I get off track, and I do, like all of us, right? I get thrown off. I inevitably, like if I'm in a stress, unfortunately for me, it's less and less, and you know, I'm usually pretty good, but you know, but there is, you know, I have stretches where I sort of look up and I'm like, you know, why am I frustrated? Why am I not happy? Why am I not, what's going on? And inevitably it comes down to the fact that somehow I've gotten off course and the things I've been focusing on are not in alignment with what I'm here to do. And I need to true it back up.
That's very sound advice. I love this interview, Corey. This has been great. If people want to find out more about what you do, grab your book on Amazon, Authentic Negotiating, and follow your work, where can they find you?
So the best single hub is CoreyKupfer.com. That's CoreyKupfer.com. From there, they can get, and I got some blogs on there, videos, some of my media hits, all that kind of stuff. They can get a link through to Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, pick up the book. I also have on there, by the way, an authentic negotiating success quiz. So if people wanted to just figure out in 11 questions, it takes 5-7 minutes, just where they stand in terms of how much of an authentic negotiator they are or not, they can take that quiz, they'll get some instant results, and then also get some feedback on things that they can do. So it's CoreyKupfer.com.
There you have it, Corey Kupfer. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's been great to be with you, Gilbert. Appreciate being on.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. You can find more episodes every Tuesday. If you haven't done so, please subscribe for more updates as they come. Until next time.